Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Lisa Hawkins, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is The Frontline of Development, A Civil Affairs Officer's Experience Working in Afghanistan. Today's guest is Arielle, and she's the president of the Student Advisory Committee for MIAJ, and she will welcome our guest, right? Yep. Please join me in welcoming Arielle.
Well, good afternoon. Can you guys hear me? Okay. So real quick, we just wanted to give a quick overview of what the Masters of International Affairs and Global Enterprise, or MIAJ, is for interested students. MIAJ is an interdisciplinary program that pulls coursework from the best of the best of all the graduate programs here at the University of Utah. So it's meant for students who have an interest in international affairs in this increasingly globalized world. So we, like I said before, we select like some of the best classes from all the different graduate programs. So, for example, public administration, public policy, the political science department, anthropology, economics, law, business, marketing, management, pretty much anything to provide a well-rounded, realistic education so that our students have the tools they need to compete in this increasingly globalized world. So most MIAJ students, they go anywhere and everywhere. You can go to private business, private enterprises, nonprofit sector. A lot of our students go to international NGOs or local nonprofits. A lot of students also go to government office. So, for example, we have Dane Sawyer here today, who's a MIAJ student who was a civil affairs officer for the U.S. Army. We've had students intern and work all over the globe. So our degree is actually pretty short, which is great for a master's degree. It's only 36 credits, which means that you can finish in as little as 3 semesters going full-time. So you take 6 core classes, and then you get 6 elective classes. And the electives, like I said, can be from pretty much all the graduate departments. In addition to the course requirement, there's an independent research project or a thesis. And the thesis is more if you intend to go on to get a PhD or something afterwards. But the research project is usually you do a lot of research in your graduate degree, and so you kind of you can pull off of what you've done in the past and build on that for your research project. There's a comprehensive exam, which this is the best part of MIAJ, is it can be substituted by an international internship. So almost all graduate programs require some sort of master's comp. It's this really scary, really long test, but MIAJ students can get out of it by going and doing an internship, which will not only build your resume and your career and give you great options, but saves you all that stress. There's also a second-year language competency at the end of the program. So, for example, it can be pretty much any language. Mine was French. There's Arabic. Pretty much any language you want is available here at the University of Utah to take, or you can take a competency test. So our core curriculum, these are the 6 classes, international management through the David Eccles School of Business, so you're with all the MBA students. Multinational firms, international trade investment is an econ class taught by the director of the program, Stephen Reynolds. International relations is a political science course. Methods of social research, which is a great course that helps establish and build upon your qualitative and quantitative research abilities. A law course, which there is no set law course. It's anything that strikes your fancy that has an international emphasis, be it international law, European law, international business transactions. There are several that we can choose. And then the foundations of MIAJ course with our director, Stephen Reynolds. Like I said, you after those 6 core classes, you choose 6 electives, and they can come from any of these departments, which is great because, so for example, if you know that you want to talk about security and you want to be in the security field, then you can take a geography class on terrorism. You can take the law class on global perspectives on terrorism. You can take the political science class, politics and terrorism. You can take the anthropology class of anthropology of violence. It's a great program that you can really choose and tailor your education to fit your career goals that you have. So it's really great. It allows you most flexibility out of pretty much any graduate program. I, you know, really considered a lot of other places, and this was the by far the best because it gave me the education I wanted for the career I wanted. Rather than, you know, a cookie cutter, everyone has the same courses, everyone does the same thing and has the same skill sets. It's so flexible and tailorized exactly to what you want your education to be. Admission is selective, but there's no, like, official undergrad needed. So we've got people who are English majors, political science, international relations, business, accounting, marketing. Everybody can fit into the MIAJ program as long as you have an interest in international affairs. We take the GRE, GMAT, or LSAT, and we require that you have a statistics class, a micro, and a macroeconomics course. And you can be accepted without having taken those classes, but you will need to complete those kinds of classes before you can take our core curriculum classes. So if you want to apply, go to www.miaj.utah.edu. Our next application date is September 1st to start in January. And what's great about MIAJ, too, is if you can start over the summer, spring, or fall semester. So it's an ongoing enrollment basis. You don't have to, if you graduate in December, you can jump right into it in January rather than waiting a whole nother year. So if you have any questions or if you want more information, we have flyers in the back and business cards. And also our offices are over with the Center for Public Policy and Administration, which is 214 of the OSH. So now let's move on to why you guys are actually here, is to listen to Dane Sawyer. Dane is a native of Yuba City, California. He did his undergraduate at BYU in political science. After graduation, he completed officer candidate school, and he graduated there at Fort Benning in Georgia in 2010. Dane started the MIAJ program in fall 2011 and was deployed to Afghanistan. Well, he started his training in January 2012, left for Afghanistan in April 2012, and returned January 2013, so a little bit less than a year abroad. And he is now the current first lieutenant of the 405th Civil Affairs Battalion and a MIAJ student. So let's all welcome Dane for the presentation.
Thank you. I just wanted to say a few things about the MIAJ program. They've been really good with working with me. As a reservist, I deployed to Afghanistan and came back. And Christy Reese, she's been really good working with me, as well as Dr. Reynolds. So it's a great program, and I've loved all the classes that I've had the ability to do. Also like to welcome everyone here. Thank friends and family for coming. Like to welcome a special person. He's going to hate me for this, but one of my team members is here that went to Afghanistan with me. Sergeant First Class Peter Scott is in the back. So he made me look really good out there. He did most of the work on the team, to be honest. And as head of security, kept me alive out there. So I wanted a special welcome for him. So as I was putting this together, I kind of got in the mindset that I was putting together another briefing for colonels and whoever else I had to brief. And so I had to take a step back, and I wanted to put together something that was a lot more fun than what I'm used to briefing. So with that in mind, I'm just going to tell a few stories. It's about my experience in Afghanistan of 2012-2013. I'm not an official representative of the United States Army or the University of Utah. I'm not going to try to get too extreme with my views or opinions today, but I've intentionally left out names, places in this presentation. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about what civil affairs is, what a civil affairs officer does, what a civil affairs team does, as well as the kind of the environment we were working in. Then I'm going to talk about, give a few stories about kind of the challenges that we faced in Afghanistan. So this is a civil. This is what a civil affairs team does. Made up of four members: there's a team leader, a team sergeant, and two other civil affairs guys on the team. Our core tasks are listed there and highlighted. This is what we focused on in Afghanistan: civil information management, nation assistance, and support to civil administration. And what we really focused on, as U.S. forces are withdrawing from Afghanistan, is supporting the civil administration they have in place and making sure that they're ready for that transition. We also were liaisons with other agencies, whether it was U.S. agencies like USAID or international agencies. We were the liaison in Afghanistan in our specific battle space that we worked in, with the Army, making sure everyone was on the same page. And down at the bottom left, you can see that that's the civil affairs team. So we're kind of at the bottom where everything came together. And some people called us diplomats with guns because we were able to do the development work and governance work in highly contested areas because we are trained soldiers. So that's the difference between an aid worker or an NGO worker and us. This was the team that I worked on. As you can see, some of us are happier to be there than others. But we called ourselves Team Tortuga. This was at Thanksgiving. So this was our four-man team. So this is what we thought we did out there in our minds. We thought we attended only the most important meetings. We thought we were vital to fighting off hordes of Taliban. And the people loved us, obviously, in our minds. This is what other people thought we did, especially other soldiers. They had, honestly, no idea what we did. They thought we just went around teaching kids how to read. And if you look at the picture, the kid's actually holding the book upside down. So I guess we weren't doing a great job. But they thought we just went out saving the world and just rebuilding Afghanistan. So, but this is what we actually did. I wrote a ton of reports, just countless hours. Found exciting ways to clean vehicles, as you can see. Contemplated growing mustaches, and then actually went through with it. Grew mustaches, pet a lot of cats. So it was a good time in Afghanistan. So we worked at the subnational level, and a lot of times you hear a lot about what's going on at the national level. That's the news you hear because national level, they're the ones who give the press releases, and everyone's interested in that. But we worked at much lower echelons. We were working with districts and provinces, which are far separated from Kabul, the main government. So it would be something like working at county level or city level here, which was interesting because, like I said, it's where a lot of the real work gets done. Just a few characteristics about the government of Afghanistan. It's really centralized the way the constitution was set up. There are a lot of different reasons why they did that, but government appointments are done from Kabul. So district leaders and officials are appointed from Kabul, and they were assigned to come down. Money flows from Kabul, so they didn't have discretionary funds down at the lowest level. So if you can imagine like a city council or a state governor not having his own money without the approval of like almost every expenditure, the approval of the central government. So it's something that's a little foreign to American concept. Provincial level leaders had minimal funds that were provided by the USAID. So it was virtually nothing. And then at the district level, like at the county level, what would be county level here, leaders had almost no money. And if they did, well, they shouldn't have had it. So there were a few times where, well, we saw some money and we were like, whoa, I don't know if that should be here. I'll skip through that. So some of the challenges we faced, like I said, we were trying to support the government there. It's called GIRO, if you hear me. Refer to it. It's the government of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, which we call GIROA. We're trying to support them so that they would be less reliant on outside help and ready for transition. They were often perceived as corrupt. And whether this is true or not, this was a challenge we faced because it was the general perception. Because appointments were done in Kabul and people generally did not know how that process worked. Including myself, we would just find out about a new official that had been appointed. So shadow governors existed in a lot of the districts we worked in. So the Taliban had set up their own government in a lot of these districts, and the people were very familiar with the Taliban counterparts of the government there. And foreign attempts to foster governance and development often undermined the independence of Jairoa, or getting them to function independently. Also in Afghanistan, it's very tribal. There are a lot of tribes that live in Afghanistan, a lot of times speaking different languages. There are Uzbeks, Pashtuns, which I worked with the majority of the time, Tajiks, and Hazaran people. So these are just a lot of times they don't even look the same. So just looking at them, you can tell some, like the Hazara, are Shia Muslim, and the other tribes are Sunni. So there are a lot of differences. But even within the Pashtuns, there are often sub-tribes and then sub-tribes, and then it gets down to the village, which they identify with. So this is where we operated within this tribal society. So as a governance and development officer, when you get on ground in a country that's developing, I mean, there's a lot that needs to be developed and a lot that needs to be done. So this is kind of a matrix of how we would approach some of the problems. And this is called the SOI analysis. And this is sources of instability. We tried to identify sources of instability when we got to a location, and then we would try to target that source of instability. So there was a lot that needed to be done, and we couldn't do everything, obviously. And so we had to pick a few things where we felt like, number one, some progress could be made, and number two, this was something that was really affecting the society. So if you look through the matrix here, I don't know if there's a pointer on here, right here. This is one of my favorite and most important boxes. Does this grievance undermine the normal functioning of society? So Afghanistan and the United States are very different countries. So a lot of times you would get American workers that were trying to make Afghanistan into America. And when they would set up programming, for example, they would go to a village or think about a village and say, oh, this is horrible. There's no sewage system in this village. This is definitely a source of instability. People can't live like this. Well, normal functioning society in Afghanistan is oftentimes in villages without sewage, so it's completely normal for them. So instead of putting effort behind something like a sewage system, a lot of money and time, they would bypass that. You would want to bypass that because it doesn't undermine normal functioning society. And I'll get more into that as I tell these stories. So the first story I like to tell is some of the work we did with schools. This picture is kind of funny because this is Afghan border police that helped us do a book distribution. We had a program where we would give out books, and there was a radio broadcast, and they could follow along and learn how to read Pashto. But they were helping us that day, and we gave them the books, and they kind of just, like, threw them to the kids. Schools faced unique problems. Taliban really liked to focus on schools, intimidating the children, intimidating the teachers, making sure that curriculum that they wanted taught was being taught in the schools. Coalition forces also like to focus on schools. There's a big emphasis on education, not only in the United States, but internationally. It was the focus of a lot of building, a lot of resources. So schools were a highly contested area when we got there. And we did some work with schools. So we worked in this valley, Lewane Valley. And I'm just going to tell this story. There was a school there that was unused. And what happened was, as we worked with some of the government officials there, especially the education officials, they started asking us for tarps. And, you know, it was kind of, we're like, well, okay, well, why do you need tarps? Why are you asking us for tarps? And they said it was because they had children that were meeting in a school that was too small, and they wanted tarps so the children could sit underneath that. I mean, on the outside, it sounds like a pretty legitimate request, but there are a lot of underlying factors and things that go into that. there was a school which was about over here in the valley that was new. It was unused. It had a nice security wall around it. And so we asked them about the school, and they said it just wasn't secure. So the backstory is coalition forces had funded a school in this valley, and locals had helped build the school, were hired by the project. And after it was built, some bad guys came in and threatened some kids. And so they abandoned the school to this their old school, and they said, well, this school's not going to function without a security wall. So another U.S. organization decided to build a security wall around the school, you know, because they didn't want the school to go to waste at considerable cost. And after that was built, another bad guy came in broad daylight and threatened some kids again. They said he beat up a kid. I don't know, but so they abandoned the school a second time after the wall was built. And then that's when they were asking for tarps. So it was a little frustrating for us because as we patrolled and would go on missions in this valley, it was really contested. So we would get in a lot of ambush situations and firefights there. And, you know, it was frustrating for us because we were more than willing to help with the security of the children here and of the school. And they had a lot of police and army there. And they were having a hard time securing their own children. So it was frustrating for us. But the tarps, we got down to it. And number one thing that it taught us is that they're unwilling to ask for help for their normal systems to function. In Afghanistan, they would go to their provincial counterpart and they would submit a request. And that request would get approved. And that's the way that would work. And they were unwilling to do that. For something simple as a tarp, and they were much more eager to ask us for a tarp. And number two, I mean, even if in Afghanistan, tarps are, like, relatively inexpensive. So if they really cared a lot about their children and those that they had, they could have gone to the bazaar and spent $2 on a tarp. But those are kind of the problems that we faced. We ended up not helping them with the tarp, hoping that they would do their due diligence and secure that for themselves. Best case scenario, have kids go back to that school and work with security forces there. So those are some of the challenges we faced there. Another program that we had, we helped work to expand access to capital. Wrote some notes, but I talk too much to even follow these. In Afghanistan, traditionally, what we found out is meeting with farmers and locals is that they would meet with their buyers. If they were selling agricultural goods, they'd meet with their buyers. They would sell their goods, and then they would take a loan or some sort of payment so that they could buy seeds and whatever tools they needed for next year's harvest. I was on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it's a really fluid border. This was generally done in Pakistan just because of the conflict in Afghanistan. They would do this in Pakistan. They'd get the money. They'd come back. Well, because of the conflict now in Pakistan, farmers were unable to do this, and they were facing challenges of what crops they could grow. They ended up just growing wheat, which was relatively cheap to grow, as opposed to other cash-producing crops. So USAID got behind an initiative to expand access to capital through private loans. And, you know, it was an uphill battle. Less than 10% of Afghans had bank accounts or have bank accounts now. Private lending was non-existent in Afghanistan. And culturally as well, it's debated still whether taking loans and having a bank accrue interest is against Islam. So this was a problem that USAID faced. Okay. And so what they ended up doing is they hired an Afghan to manage this, and he would go around and he would make presentations about the opportunities that the farmers had as well as other people had to get access to this capital. What we did is we helped facilitate his visits to the districts. And This was one initiative we got behind. We thought that this was a source of instability that we could help foster access to capital. And what we were trying to get was farmers to diversify, maybe be able to plant orchards, which the nuts and the fruit would produce a lot more as far as money, as well as other crops such as saffron or something like that. So this was another example of a initiative we got behind. So this is probably my favorite story, the district center windows. And I just drew this on here. On one side, if Jairoa is fully supported by coalition force, they're not going to be independent and able to function on their own. And on the other side of the spectrum, without support, they will be an independent entity and able to function on their own. So this story about the district center windows, it's pretty comical, but it shows just kind of where this district was on the scale here. So here's a picture of the district center windows. We were having a really serious meeting. It probably wasn't that serious, to be honest, but a bee flew in and completely disrupted the meeting. And this is Sergeant First Class Scott shooing the bee away because this Afghan was a little scared to do it. So it was disruptive as a problem. What had happened in this district center is a suicide bomber filled a truck full of explosives, drove himself into the district center, blew himself up. Fortunately, nobody was really hurt, but it blew out all the windows of this district center. So they had like plastic tarps and everything. So when you visit this district center, that's one of the first things you notice is there are plastic tarps instead of windows in a pretty nice facility. So background, like I said, the government of Afghanistan runs off a lobbying model. Nothing can happen unless those working at the district center would go to their provincial counterparts and say, hey, we have no windows. Can you please help us out? Culture, we found out, played an important role because it was culturally embarrassing or awkward, as they explained it to us, for them to go to their provincial counterparts. We even saw some officials that would get up and talk to their people, and as a measure of their success, they would say, I'm such a good leader, I've never asked my hire for anything. And, you know, we're sitting back there like, oh, wow, like, that's probably why nothing's getting done in your district. So, yeah, nothing gets done without that lobbying. Also, at the higher levels, they said it was also embarrassing for them to come down and visit people at the lower levels. So you had, like, a cultural barrier with people working with each other, and that's something that's hard for us to understand in the United States because we're so used to the management role and the supervisory role and people following up on each other. So the district center windows, they had been out for a year, and we had spent a lot of time and effort just focusing on these windows. We would always ask them, what's up with the windows? When are they going to get replaced? And we would invariably get the same answers. Yeah, we put the request in months ago, and we're just waiting on province. And then we talk to people that work at province, and they'd be like, yeah, we're just waiting on a request from the district. And it would go back and forth, and seriously, it would come up in like every meeting we had about these, what's going on with these district center windows. This is a funny picture because we had kind of a formal dinner once to say goodbye to a USAID worker. And after the dinner, this gentleman here, he worked at the provincial level, and he was like, you know, he was fired up. He wanted to get something done. So this is the district official there, the district governor, and he was like, I'm going to talk to him, and I'm going to get to the bottom of this. So he went and he went to talk to him to get to the bottom of this, and I walked over, and I saw his face. He worked at the district level, and he heard the story a million times, and I was like, well, what are you guys talking about? Why is it so serious right now? And he just gave me that look, and I was like, what? He's like, the district center windows. He was just did not. So that's the look that you get when nothing's getting done, and you spend just countless hours talking to people about it. We actually left this area before the windows got replaced, and we found out that they subsequently did get replaced. It was funny because like a month leading up to it, I would always check up on it, and I would hear, oh, yeah, the glasses bought. A guy's on his way down. This afternoon he will be here. And then the next day I'd show up and, you know, no windows. So it was pretty comical. Some of the lessons I learned from this, and I had to write them down because I didn't learn them very well. What foreign workers may think is important to Afghans or to any local, it may not be important to them. These windows, there was probably a reason they didn't get replaced. They probably didn't care. They probably thought it felt good in the summer, honestly, without windows. So that's something that we needed to keep in mind. And we need to adjust our efforts and programming in all areas to the cultural to the culture of where we're operating. Also, peace shuras. There was a program set up in Afghanistan called the Afghan Peace and Reintegration Program. This was to try to get Taliban fighters to come reintegrate back into the government and to come forward. And they set that up with, they would offer a stipend, a three-month stipend, for them to come in, offer a safe house. Coalition forces had kind of a sister program. It was called the Afghan Reintegration Program. And our vision for that was not to undermine the Afghan system, to let it function, and just to help out, you know, kind of where there were gaps or holes. But largely, this is a functioning program, and it really helped. And we thought we could support this program and get it off the ground by supporting the Afghan officials. So what we did was we tried to support their traditional means of outreach. So we looked at their culture and, you know, we gave it to them. We said, look, we're here to support you guys. Whatever you think is a good means of outreach culturally for you, we will support you in that. Some coalition thought it would be good to put up billboards and banners. That's not necessarily what they did culturally. What they did was they would hold shuras, which are big meetings with village elders, and the village elders would get up and give sometimes really lengthy speeches about why it was important and speak with mullahs, their religious leaders, and have them go and speak with the people. And this was a really effective way to share information in Afghanistan. So what we did is we helped plan these meetings with the Afghans, and we said we would support them by buying them a meal. So it was a really wasn't very much money that we were spending at these meetings. But one of the things that we assessed that could help them become more independent and functional as a government is we had them prepare a detailed pishnahad, which in Pashto means it's a request. So what we may think in the United States is, you know, just writing a request is something that everybody knows how to do. With a young government, with officials that, you know, are just starting to function, this isn't something that they're used to doing. So we worked with them to help them prepare these requests, who would attend, how many people would attend, the price that they needed to request. And, you know, it was a lengthy process, but we had a lot of good sit-down meetings with these officials and helped them out. Also, they felt confident in going to their provincial leaders and asking and showing them, even though they said it was culturally embarrassing, but they were prepared with a good product, and they would show them the request, and their leaders got it approved, and they were invited to attend. And in a lot of these meetings, we did get provincial leaders that actually came down to the districts and attended. And they had to provide a vendor, so a restaurant owner or a hotel manager that would take the payment. This was kind of hard because traditionally, American forces just would like to pay the district official and be like, ah, he'll take care of it. But that can introduce corruption and them taking a little cut of the money. So this is how we helped them out. These were really successful meetings. And just as far as governance and development goes, yeah, there were small meetings. The word did get out. It was a lot of work that went into these on our parts, and all we were doing was buying lunch. But everyone was happy with the meetings. And funny story about the first meeting we went to, coalition forces weren't going to go, but you know, the Afghans were like, oh, come, please, come. They wanted our colonel, our lieutenant colonel, to go attend the meeting to show support. So we showed up, and we were kind of sitting on the outside doing security. And, you know, our two colonels walked in. And I guess the Taliban really hated the idea of this meeting because they started with a pretty big ambush on us in this valley. And it lasted for 3 hours. But I guess when the fighting started, there were a lot of booms and explosions. And all the Afghans in the meetings just sat there like it was normal. And the two Americans, like, jumped under the table. And all the Afghans made fun of them, just pointing and laughing. So, but the meeting went on like it was nothing. So there's some pretty tough people out there, that's for sure. This is the last story I'm going to talk about, is the Village Work Program. So we'd been in Afghanistan for a while. We felt like we knew the culture. We'd been finding out these interesting things about the culture and where to put our efforts in programming. And the question is raised, like, I don't know how long we were there before we asked. It was like, how did Afghanistan function before Coalition was here? Like, they ask us for everything. How did they even function? And it was two things. We realized we're only noticing what they're asking us for, but there's a lot of stuff going on that's completely independent of our efforts. They actually are doing a lot for their own country. We just are asked a million times for things, so it's our perception that they're not doing anything for themselves, number one. Number two, there was a traditional way that they functioned as a society, and it was a lot different than any other country. And it was in development. They have a lot of labor that's ready and available to work for their community. The tribes come together a lot, and they work really hard for their tribe. So if a village needed something, traditionally the males of that village would work together and help their tribal members out. If a house needed to be built, cousins and tribal members would go, and they would help build that, you know, without any pay. And so that was the traditional system. So we came up with a program with the Afghans about helping their villages. So we, let's see, there was a mosque that had been damaged. We visited this village, and it was completely crumbled. The roof had crumbled, the walls had crumbled, and this village elder was asking us for help. He said, you know, look, we have a mosque, and this is the focal point of our community, and we need help. And we're asking everybody, so we're asking you too. Can we get some help? So we went back and we talked with the district sub-governor. We talked with some other Afghan officials, and together we came up with a plan that showed significant buy-in from the Afghans, meaning they had some stake in the game. So coalition forces sometimes would go in and just like say, okay, we'll take care of it. You know, don't worry about it. That's not how Afghan society functions. So we came up with a program where we would supply these tools. These are the tools here. These are government officials that worked for the sub-governor. So these villages would make another detailed request about what kind of tools they needed. And it looked like it was coming from the sub-governor. So they would make a request. They'd present it to the sub-governor. He would sit down and do his sub-governor thing, look at it, look important. And he'd put his approval on there or not, and they would take the tools, and they would rebuild what they needed, or they would build. And this was in stark contrast to just aid workers going in and saying, we'll handle this problem, we'll put the money in, we'll do it for you. It's kind of the paternalistic view. So this is the mosque, and when we went to visit the mosque and check up on it, I'm not going to lie, I was on R&R in Spain. Sergeant Scott went to check up on the mosque when I was gone. Kind of feel bad about that. But they were rebuilding it. There were young men out there working with the tools, rebuilding their mosque, doing it the traditional Afghan way, getting it done, and working for their village. And there were so many players that took part in it. We thought it was good programming for the area. There were also mortar attacks that were being conducted from that village. And I don't know if this was in correlation, but they ceased coming from that village after we helped or were perceived to help them there. So I just wanted, that was the last story. just wanted to get into development opportunities. I did work with a lot of USAID workers and other NGOs and IGOs, and the opportunities are out there, honestly. A lot of these people are hiring, and if you want to take note, all of these organizations have employment websites. I've checked them out. They have openings. If you want to do that, I talked with some of the development workers I worked with. They said the best thing to do is just get yourself out there. Just take any type of position, especially the ones that where you're going overseas. You'll meet people in the development business, and opportunities will grow from there. But they do have employment. A lot of them have internships, some sort of fellowships. So the development world's it's thriving right now because there are a lot of countries that are still in need of development, especially in areas of conflict. There are a lot of jobs still in Afghanistan, as well as other countries throughout the world. And you can also go South America, obviously, or Africa, where there's not too much conflict, if it kind of scares you off. So if you want more information on that, feel free to talk to me afterwards or contact the MIAJ program or anyone about that, and we can get you set up with some resources. So, conclusion, this is honestly, I sounded cool, but this is honestly what I did most of the time in Afghanistan. I got fed a lot. It was great. I built a lot of good relationships out there, and this is one of our female soldier counterparts that we worked with. The Afghans are great, really hospitable people. They have hopefully a bright future. There are a lot of people that are working hard. Everyone only hears the negative things that come out of Afghanistan. So with this presentation, I wanted to kind of highlight the good things that are happening over there, because there are a lot of good things. The government, the security forces are getting ready for transition, and I think the future is going to be good for Afghanistan. I have a few words that I wrote out here. So development work can be really frustrating. It's slow. A lot of times you feel like nothing's getting done, and you know, people throw their hands up and say, what else can be done? You know, I tried. It can be really frustrating, but at the same time, it can be some of the most rewarding work that you can possibly do. To see, you know, a community get helped, or just to see one person get help from your efforts, it was really rewarding to go out to Afghanistan and work that. I wrote down here, development, it's an idea. It's a concept. If you go into a place or a country and you feel like the next 5 years will be better than the past 5 years, that's the idea of development. That's the concept that the future is brighter, that the efforts you put in now will pay off. And a lot of times in these countries, the people have lost that hope. And those that are working in that country have lost that hope. So as someone who wants to work in development, it's selling that idea. And based on that idea is when you get stuff actually happening and where your efforts don't feel wasted. And also in conclusion, I was really honored to serve with people in Afghanistan that shared the same vision of development as I did. We put in countless hours of work every day, and I it's kind of funny how much we work, but not really. It wasn't funny at all. But I was honored to serve with those people that were willing to go over there, sacrifice what everyone knew what the sacrifices could be. We would sleep, we'd think about Afghanistan, we'd wake up, we'd talk about Afghanistan, and I just, one of the things that I would always tell people is I would tell the soldiers I worked with, I'd say, I just honestly wished that some Afghans that just hated us and were trying to kill us could see the work that we were putting in and could see how much we cared for them. And I was honored to serve with the people that shared that vision and goal for Afghanistan. And last thing I'm going to say is I was also honored to serve with the Afghans. They're great people. They're at a crossroad of a lot of different countries and organizations and a lot of conflict in the last 30 to 40 years. And a lot of these people have grown up only knowing conflict. So they grew up a lot in a lot harsher environment than we did, but they keep that hope. That hope's alive with them. They have a cricket team that just started and is doing really well, and they pointed it out to me like every day that the cricket teams beat the U.S. cricket team. And I would say, oh, that, wow, yeah, guys, you're doing great. But, no, they have that hope that the future's better for them. And, you know, they live in constant, not fear, but, you know, security issues all around the country. And they're doing a lot of good things for their country. So I'd like to open it up to any questions. If anyone has any questions, that's my presentation in the front.
My name is Ola Matoa, and I'm studying health society and policy here on campus. And I was just wondering, in your, like, as far as the schools go, you talked about how the schools have these security walls and how they're supposed to be safe. But what other measures do you make sure, or does the United States Army go to make sure that no other girls get shot in the head? Like, what other things are being done from your perspective that you saw on the ground?
Sure. So first, to answer that question, that's a great question. The primary responsibility is on the Afghans and their security system. They're in the lead, so we're helping mentor and support them as they take those measures to secure their children. I think the incident you're referring to actually happened in Pakistan, but yeah, so we are supporting them, giving them training, giving them support. If they're getting in, a lot of times if they would get in like really bad firefights, we'd go out and support them. But they're number one in that. So we would love to, as the U.S. Army and as Americans, we like to take control and we like to take the lead and we like to get things done, but it's not sustainable for us to do that. So to answer your questions, Afghans are taking the lead, and we're in a mentorship and support role for that. But it is a chief concern for everybody who works with the children. And we still are going on patrols in Afghanistan and helping with security that way. Next question.
Hi, my name is Adrian Spiegel. I'm a peace and conflict major, doubled with psychology. I'm just wondering, seeing that you've had personal experience overseas, how much time do you personally feel that America needs to budget in Afghanistan? How much more time do we have left there in order for the Afghanis to basically stand on their own feet and be able to start reconstructing themselves independently?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. You know, unfortunately, that's like echelons way higher than I worked at, to be able to like strategically plan how much more time we have to spend there. What I can tell you is that our efforts there aren't being wasted. There's considerable progress being made the longer that we're there. And, some places are already fully transitioned, no American help at all. So, some places need some time, and, you know, 2014, ready or not, here it comes. So that's all I can add. That doesn't really answer your question, but that's when it's being transitioned.
My name's Jefferson. I'm a gender studies major here at the U. My question is, there are a lot of cultural differences you mentioned between the way that Afghanistan works and the way the United States works. So I'm curious, how did you guys try to reconcile those differences in terms of development? And did you try to assimilate more to their culture? Did you try to assimilate them to our culture? Or was it a combination of both?
Yeah, what we first thing was learning the culture. You know, there are two mindsets over there. One mindset is, you know, I'm just going to be American, do things the American way, get things done the American way. And then there are those that really go out of their way to learn the culture. And it's more, honestly, it's more frustrating to do the second way, to learn the culture and try to work that way. But it's, I think you touched on it, it's really significant and important to work through the traditional cultural norms as you find out where to put your efforts and programming. So doing that learning process is invaluable to development work.
Hi, I'm Satine. I'm a political science pre-med major here. And my question is, What effects of agriculture and opium have you seen on the ground in regards to development? I know that has a great portion of their economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe 10 years ago, there was a lot more opium. And there was a lot more revenue being generated by opium. I personally never saw a single opium field in Afghanistan. So it was eradicated where I was. I know it was still being grown in other places. But I can just speak from experience. I didn't see any opium. There was hashish being grown in large numbers, so marijuana. But not the best crop. But the farmers we talked to, they were trying to transition out of it because they knew it was, number one, against Islam, and number two, not good for their society. So they were trying to transition. They said it was a crop of last resort. So everyone's trying to transition out of those crops as we speak. So,
my name is Gabriel Peterson. My question is, so sometimes in America and the mainland, the war can be viewed in a very negative way. But my question is, how is U.S. presence viewed by the Afghan general population instead of what do the Americans think about what we're doing?
Yeah, that's a good question. Wherever we went, for the most part, Afghans loved talking to us. The kids would run up to us and talk to us and ask us for pins. They love pins over there. I don't know why, but Afghans were really friendly to us, would invite us into their homes and their offices of work and give us tea and bread and meals. And they like us being there. We bring security. We bring, you know, development. It's generally a positive view. You get occasionally, obviously, the Taliban influence. And unfortunately, they recruit, like, the less educated people that are just grown up to hate Americans, that view Americans as one of their enemies. We wouldn't interact with them very often, you know, and but we knew they were there because they chewed at us. But yeah, so it's generally a positive light. Occasionally they complain about little things. You helped this guy, but why aren't you helping me? You know, just I think that's normal, but it's very positive in Afghanistan. And before the president announced the final date, or before it was really clear what was going on with our exit, the Afghans were really concerned, and a lot of them were sad when there was a date when we were going to be leaving. And they expressed concern. They said, oh, man, I wish you guys would stay for a lot longer. And they saw us completely different as Russia, because when Russia invaded Afghanistan, it was like, we're going to set up our government. We're going to stay. This is going to be part of the USSR. But Americans were going in there. We're helping develop this government, and then we're out. We don't have any, like, long-term colonization plans like the Russians did. So, next question.
Hey, my name's Caleb Albers. I'm just wondering, like, as a person, what's the most important thing you feel like you've learned from your experience over there?
As a person, that's a great question. I think probably the most important thing to learn is just, even though things don't look like there's any progress, or even though you may not be getting support from anybody that works in your organization, just keep the goal in sight, you know. Invest your efforts and be willing to say, you know, even though I invested everything I had into this, nothing got done, but I honestly, like, worked to exhaustion to get this done. So I think it's just knowing that, believing in what you're doing and putting everything you have into that and not sacrificing depending on what other people are saying. Question.
How is the...
Just a moment. There's a microphone.
Okay. My name is James Bybee. Did you ever see a problem with the mullahs or the imams or the madrasas in your area? And also being there on the Pakistan border, dealing with ISI and the Pakistanis that were counter to the progress that you were trying to do in that area or that province that you were working in.
Have you been to Afghanistan?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I got one more question, if that's okay.
Yeah, I think he's been to Afghanistan. Yeah, that's a really informed question. There was always this perception that, you know, there were anti-American mullahs. And without getting into much detail, I did meet with mullahs, and I did work with them, even in highly contested Taliban areas. And it's unfortunate because I think as Americans, we kind of want to take the whole religion piece out of it. And Americans, like, I'd set up meetings, and I'd say, oh, these mullahs are going to attend the meeting. And then some Americans would be like, oh, I don't know about that. Jeez, you know? And Afghanistan is such a religiously based community. It's something that needs to be addressed, and it's a segment of the community that needs to be worked with. And we need to get rid of that perception that mullahs are all anti-American and they hate Americans, because it's just not true. And that's a general perception held by a lot of Americans. As well as the ISI question, I didn't work in intelligence, so, and even if I did, I probably wouldn't answer that question.
All right, one more question. Being in civil affairs, mm-hmm. and dealing with that part of building a government, mm-hmm. Yeah, we're supposed to be pulling out of there in 2014. Let's say long-term, down the range, is Afghanistan going to be able to support themselves without our help, without the communities, without the world helping them financially, or even as a leader? And I know it's down the road, mm-hmm. but from your position as building a nation, were you able to see any glimpse of, hey, yeah, they think they're getting it, or it's going to take a little longer?
Yeah, that's a good question. So talk down the road without any support, we're talking like 30, 40, 50 years. A lot of countries have committed support for long-term time. Yeah, and we did see evidence of areas, like in the north of Afghanistan, there's virtually no violence there, and there's minimal, it's a different tribe if you've been there. They're not Pashtuns up there, but... Yeah, you do see encouraging things. It's not all perfect, that's for sure. You have districts where forces have been in for a long time that are still highly contested, yes. But
this is the last question.
Okay.
Hi. How do they deal with the issue of the different tribes in their military and security forces and having people from one tribe enforcing the law on another?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually, because in the Afghan National Army, you have a lot of people that are from the north, that are Tajik, that are Uzbek, that are Hazaran, and they're being assigned to places down in the Pashtun areas. And so it's kind of a little bit unsettling for the Pashtun people to have like these foreign foreign military, as they viewed it, in their area. But the Afghan National Army is very professional. They're trained well. They're equipped well. And there are really low incidents of any type of corruption, or at least perceived corruption, or civilian casualties. So their professionalism has taken them a long way into allowing them to operate in other tribes' areas, number one. The Afghan police, they try to assign similar tribes to the police, so Pashtun police in Pashtun areas, a lot of times trying to get people from the same village to work in that village. There are benefits to that, as well as, it might be avenues of corruption that way, but there are a lot of benefits to that, and so that's how they're mitigating that risk. That was a good question. All right, so thank you for the questions, everybody.